You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Gabriel Lester. Gabriel, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me on a long distance from Amsterdam.
Let's talk about what you're working on right now. How is Amsterdam today? I have some friends in Amsterdam. How is it there today?
Well, we've had a very, very soft winter, so it's rainy, but it's not too cold. And if you're familiar with Amsterdam, it's a typical autumn day, although we're in the middle of the winter.
Hmm. And what is it that you're working on now in your studio? I mean, I know your practice encompasses several mediums and way of working, but is there a project you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, actually. I've just been finalizing a number of texts that describe and outline a rather extensive project that kind of happened, was kind of an unforeseen twist, where initially I was invited to conceive a single installation, so a spatial work of art for an institute, due to several circumstances where one was that the director was sacked and all kinds of turbulations occurred, and it resulted in the fact that I suddenly had about a year's time to think about a number of works that I was going to propose, I guess initially in a number of 3 or 4 months, and it turned out that it started to kind of generate a body of work, or it started to begin to form the outlines for something. I think I'm like what you'd call a mid-career artist. You also have a mid-career artist crisis, I guess, meaning that you find yourself, you know, to a certain degree established, and you have a number of exhibitions and people know your work, but you need to also understand how to define your practice in the next 20 years. And I started to use this invitation that turned into this year-long research project as a means to try to define where do I want to grow, and maybe more important, how do other works or works that I've been producing in the past in a way fit into the future. So it's been a very productive year. I mean, I've done shows in between, but I've just finished this research right now.
So that's very interesting. So what you're saying is, because you had the time, as I understand what you're saying, to do this, to do a little more work on this show, the what you're talking about, which is very interesting, a kind of so-called, mid-career crisis of an artist, is looking at what you've done and where you're going for the next 20 years. So what are some of the conclusions from that, or where are you now with thinking that? Because that's also going to be articulated in an installation, I imagine, but maybe to begin with, what were your conclusions? Where are you going with that?
Well, most people who aren't artists or don't work closely with artists, they think that the actual course of events is that you start with having an idea, which you then produce in either a sketch or a mock-up, or you make your first number of sculptures, and then once all of this has been done, you invite the gallerist, the dealer, the curator to come have a look, and they might say, wow, it's going to fit into my program. But the actuality is that most of the time you already have such an invitation. You already have a scheduled exhibition or a scheduled curator who's already invited you for a deadline. And so you always work towards something very concrete. And in this process that I've just concluded, I guess, had a different way of working, and maybe much more the way I imagined, 25 years ago, the way an artist would work is you just work and see where it ends, and if it ends somewhere interesting, you go and tell the world. And I think unintentionally, maybe that's also one of the conclusions, that in fact, If you're sometimes you just find yourself on a path where there's a lot of people and there's a lot of things happening, and you get invited to have a drink somewhere or do a show, and you can find yourself, and I guess that's what defines a midlife crisis for people also. You have this moment where you suddenly realize that you don't really know, you're not really sure where you want to go, or if where you are is where you intended to go. And I think that's also something you can have as an artist, and maybe the clearest example is that you need to define a category or a field or a place of your own. And I think that's something that happens to people at a certain. You're fine with being where everybody else is, or you're fine when other people are saying, "Oh, that's an interesting place. Let's go there together." And then you get to a point where you got to go, "Wait a minute, I want to define my own place." And that's something I think I've been thinking about.
It's very interesting because I think that's something that is so much a part of artistic practice, to kind of, as opposed to making individual works and just seeing how things evolve, to have this long look over it. So, so what will be the next installation? Where are you going with work? Do you imagine you'll keep working in this vein? I mean, it seems to me you're bringing in like multiple influences, your early experiences with music and as well as building installations and all kinds of things. Is that what you imagine you'll continue to do, or your practice is about?
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, and maybe this isn't the most obvious conclusion, but I started thinking about the way you know a band or a musician makes an album. So it's striking, like, that some musicians, I don't know which music you like in particular, but when I read in the newspaper that the last album that the singer D'Angelo made was 12 years ago, which I remember, and then now 12 years onwards, he has his second or his third album that he, I don't know what he did in his life, but apparently he took another 12 years to produce a full album, and that's not very uncommon in music. Of course, you know, once everybody's digitized, you can pop out, a Britney Spears every 6 months probably, but when you want to really make a new step as a musician, you need time. So it's not unsurprisingly that you'd find musicians and filmmakers take a number of years before the next project is realized. And what happens afterwards is that then for a period of time, these musicians, they go on the road. So they're going to play, you know, whether they are going to play just nationally or they're going to go do an international tour, they're going to go and tour this new album. But obviously, whilst they're touring this new album, you know, their audience in, say, France, or their audience in Argentina, they are very happy to listen and to the live performance of the new album, but they also want to have a number of these tracks that they've become familiar with in the past. And I started thinking that as an artist, that could be some method of working where I'm just, what I've composed, without going into details, is basically a new album, and I'm going to tour this for the next couple of years. And of course, I might show a film that I made before, or an installation might be reintroduced. But in essence, it's this combination of building a body of work over a length of time, and then trying to connect this to a number of institutions or a number of events or biennials, and that might include playing an old tune. But it's essentially, you know, it's the motor behind it is, you know, the new ensemble or the new collection of, you know, works. That's,
I like, yeah. That's interesting. You know, the analogy to music is makes a lot of sense, because it is so curious how musicians often function that way. You know, there can be years between albums, and so music has always been a big influence of yours. I know you started a band before your art career, right? Was that before you became, well, I mean, it's all artists, but was that the first kind of involvement in the arts was music for you?
Yeah, I grew up in what now would be, you know, classified as a typical hippie commune. My dad was a Stanford University dropout who traveled to Europe to discover himself when he was like early 20, and then met my mom in Brussels, and they went to Amsterdam, and we went into a commune, and obviously communes, they had a lot of culture. There was a lot of singing and dancing and music. So even at the age of 9 is when I formed my first band, which is the Golden Sox Pullers. I don't know why that was the title, but that was our band, and I've been making music until I was about, I guess, early 20s, and in the Netherlands at the time where I grew up, welfare was something. We were very rich in the 80s and 90s. There was lots of money, and for an aspiring musician, it was quite easy to convince the welfare authorities that you were maybe not getting paid, but that you were, you know, working on becoming a musician. So for, I don't know, over 5 years, I managed to be a musician with, a gig left and right and some government money. And it was only when they decided that, you know, I was smart enough to get a job that I decided to study. And the writing of lyrics and the composing of music, which I also, I used, you know, computers partially to make sequences or, you know, hip-hop or house or other electronic music. And it kind of just seemed to me that if I already liked writing narratives or songs and I edited music, I wanted to study audiovisual or film. So I went to film school, and film school, I didn't conclude that, but I went and continued on to a postgraduate for fine arts. And so it was all a bit of an accident, just because I didn't make enough money to be a self-supporting musician.
That's very interesting. Well, also, but it has also to do with where you were at the time. That's something that may not happen in other countries. I mean, you're saying, so I understand correctly, you weren't working. You were a musician, and you were applying for government support for artists, which is fairly great there. Or that wasn't public support for artists. That was just public support. I mean, you mentioned there was a lot of money then. We were rich, but do you mean the country was supporting a lot of artists and had money, or what do you mean?
No, the Netherlands. Well, the Netherlands has always been known for supporting, although this has changed recently, but up till recent, the Netherlands has always been very generous in supporting artists, giving them grants or forms of stipends or subsidies. But I was just on plain welfare, and welfare in the Netherlands meant that's unemployment money. That's the money, the bare minimum that you get from the government if you don't have a job to support yourself. And it allowed me to rent a room, you know, in a house where other guys and girls were renting rooms and share a kitchen and do my music. So, you know, and smoke pot, obviously. That's, I was, like I was saying, I was 19, 20, 21, 23, you know, this
right.
age. Yeah.
And so, that's understandable. That's, it's in so many cases an artist's life. Right, it sounds like a nice life. You get to smoke pot, play music, there's some support, but at some point that ran out. So then you went back to school, as you were saying, studied fine arts, and what happened after that? That's when you began having installations, is that correct?
Well, in fact, I wanted to study cinema, but I wasn't accepted to the Amsterdam Film School, so I enrolled in the program, which is audiovisual arts, in a city in the south of the Netherlands. This drove me nuts. I didn't like the city. I didn't think the education was very good. So after a year, I went traveling, and then on my ways back, actually, from what had just become independent states of the former Soviet Union, I stopped in Brussels, where this is where my mom's from, and I actually enrolled into a course of experimental filmmaking in the Brussels Academy, and that I didn't finish either, but I went on and became a director of music videos and advertisement. This is now, we're talking 95, so what, 21 years ago, and MTV had just become popular in Europe, and so everybody needed a video clip, and I did that for a while, and then again, for reasons of I needed money and finance, I enrolled into a very known kind of postgraduate residency program called the Rijksacademie in Amsterdam. And there is where I was only working with visual artists, and I kind of discovered, hey, wait a minute, everything I've been doing as a musician, as a writer, as a filmmaker, in a way can also be understood as something sculptural or three-dimensional. And this is where I started building stage sets, or I started, making sound pieces that were, you know, what you'd call an art installation. And I guess it all came down to the fact that cinema, which is also referred to as the impure medium, because it kind of like takes a bit of painting, takes a bit of architecture, takes some choreography and literature and theater and music, that all these different elements that constitute cinema, in a way you could still make cinema, but you didn't necessarily have to have a camera to do so. And so I was also, I remember one of the early articles about my installations was that I was considered to be a filmmaker without a camera. And I guess that's what I'd done for, or I still do in a large amount of my project, is I make these narrative experiences almost. They aren't very explicit, but they are cinematographic somehow, but they don't employ video or film.
And so how are they? I mean, just so that there'll be images and links to a lot of things in this interview, but how do you mount a show, if you can describe how one of them actually looks and relates to cinema?
Well, the first piece I did, I guess, was the closest related to cinema. This is where I collected a number of soundtracks from not so known movies, or like say B movies. At that time, VHS tapes were becoming DVDs, and so I bought like lots and lots of VHS tapes from a shop that was, trying to get rid of them. And I just scouted all these different soundtracks that would represent certain, recognizable cinematographic harmonies or melodies. So, I mean, they're quite easy to recognize. I mean, it's very difficult to mistake a sad tune for something exciting. So if you take kind of a cross-section of the archetypes of cinema music, like victory, defeat, love, longing, isolation, euphoria, horror, terror, and I strung those together, sampled them basically, and used set noise like people getting out of a car or the sounds of a square. And I made this long, like soundscape soundtrack. And instead of using this music and these sounds as a kind of, to support a film or a video, what I did is I built an actual space, and I had 50 colored spotlights that I would run through a computer. And I would program these lights like you would edit a movie. So when you would hear a car, you'd close your eyes and you'd see, hey, wait a minute, it's night, obviously it's raining, there's these cars passing, and then we hear people walking. And then I would imagine, how would this look if it were just light, like if it were your opposite neighbor watching TV in the dark, if you understand this illustration. And so what the installation became is just a room that has light and sound, but it generates all these imaginary images and imaginary scenes, and it kind of functions like pantomime does. Like if I would play a pantomime flute, you'd say, oh, you're playing a flute, but it's not it's just the way I gesture my fingers that would suggest this flute. And in the same kind of mechanism or logic, these lights and these sounds would suggest these scenes. And that's one of the first pieces of which I would say maybe it's like a film in mime.
That's very interesting. So what's happening is actually what the term I've sometimes heard is psychonauts. It's about a process, images that are actually happening inside the mind, almost like when you close your eyes and press on the lids, you begin to see colors. Is it mm-hmm. is there a process that's at all like that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, strictly visually, you could compare it the way it looks, because it is like looking through a fog or like a world out of focus, but you could still distinguish depth or movement or intensity of movement. But when you look at it, I was trying to explain, is that I think the thing that for me is most similar is this idea of gestured, to gesture a presence of something, as you would do in mime or pantomime, that you can if you constitute enough information around a certain movement or gesture, it becomes convincing. Huh? Like if you could stand up now and pretend you have a baseball bat and you would swing it, but you don't need that thing for me to understand exactly what gesture you're making. So there's a kind of cognitive conditioning or coding of your movements and your body language that is enough for me to know where we are or what you're trying to express. And I think to a degree that's already in cinema. Cinema has a wonderful element of conditioning its viewer to understand things by not so much by necessarily explicitly showing it, but by showing everything around it. I think one of the most exciting things in cinema is when we're not shown the actual action, but everything around it is constitutes its existence.
Ted, and that's, and that does make clear literally what's actually happening, and it also makes clear the critic's remark you said that he's kind of a filmmaker without a camera. So
I mean,
this process is I'm sorry. Go on. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say that I guess there's been a period where I've been annoyed a bit by this analogy with cinema, because in a way I've only arrived to cinema through literature, music, and theater. As cinema, I mean, cinema in itself is the conclusion of these three. You know, these are very prominent in the way cinema has been shaped. It's either staged acting, it's either music or images set to music, or it's a narrative. And so literature, cinema, and theater have been equally important. But, you know, in our audiovisual-driven society and culture, the easiest comparison is always like, oh, it's very filmic or cinematographic. And I've had periods where I thought, no, it's much more than that. You know, film is just the result of the collection of a number of very important, very old media.
Right, it's an entirely different experience.
Yeah.
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, but I've come to terms with it, and I understand that, in fact, the you know, also because now, when I made the piece that I was just describing, there was no, you know, there was no internet, let alone things like YouTube or iPhones. But by, you know, now 2016, our interaction with audiovisual media, you know, it's so vast. I mean, even, I don't know what phone brand you have, but the chances that you're in the subway and that somebody else's phone rings, but rings with the exact same sound that yours does, you know, these weird kind of coincidental, you know, shared audiovisual, realities, they're so intertwined that, in fact, yes, cinema and its offspring, the digital world, its websites and interfaces are, in fact, maybe the most prominent language that we employ. And I've just lived for 3.5 years in Shanghai, and I don't speak Chinese, or at least very little, but my ability to communicate through images seems to be extremely easy, because the Shanghainese are talking, quote-unquote, speaking or communicating with the same media as I am. So that was really striking, and that's where I started to get comfortable with the idea that, yes, in fact, maybe a lot of what I'm doing is related to this understanding of how can we construct and deconstruct, you know, audiovisual language in order to either, you know, propose a narrative or propose a space or propose an artwork.
And that's much more clear. So to bring us back to the present, in closing this, currently you're also teaching as well as exhibiting. Is that the case?
Yeah, I do a number. I'm teaching in the postgraduate and in the normal undergraduate in Amsterdam. And now I'm doing graduation. I'm helping students to graduate of a master's in actually retail and interior design. True, I teach and make art, and I run a small commissioned art architectural company called Polylester, because I wanted to kind of divide or separate commissioned art, which has always been a way for me to generate an income from the autonomous works, not unlike many musicians have. I mean, I like funk music, as you noticed maybe earlier, but George Clinton had Parliament and Funkadelic, and they really served to have an experiment in one and try to score hits in the other. And I've always enjoyed the fact that that an artist can have a number of outputs or a number of appearances rather than to just stack everything into one thing. So Polylester is one part, and Gabriel Lester is me as an artist, and then there's Les Star Film, which is with an A, and that's where I post or produce my films and strict cinema, so really video and film works.
And Polylester at the moment, what's happening there? I mean, should we close by talking about a project of Polylester or something that's upcoming that?
We did the Festival of Love on the South Bank Center, on the South Bank of London, by commission by the South Bank Center and the Hayward Gallery, last year, which was a pavilion where which hosted performances and poetry readings, and David Byrne of the Talking Heads played there, and there was a weekend of same-sex marriages. And so we built this beautiful pavilion on the South Bank, and that led to a new commission for a new train station in the center of Utrecht, which is a city in the Netherlands. But Polylester is currently also working on a design for a public sculpture for the University of Sports and Science in Oslo, and we're doing quite a lot. But it's always like this is, I have a studio and an office, and in my office is where Polylester is. And so I have like three architects in the office, and then some people producing stuff. So that really is like a small little architecture firm making things. But it's online. It's polylester.com, and you can go and check it out.
So Gabriel, in total, what you're doing is almost like a tour of your music. Would you say that?
Yeah, well, that's what I tried to describe earlier, is the fact that this period that I've just concluded by writing a number of texts and designing a number of making a number of sketches is in fact a proposition for an album that I want to tour, and it's not a music album, but it's an album of works that I want to tour around the world for the next coming years.
So the idea of a tour of an artist being modeled on the tour of a musician.
Indeed, yes. And instead, and I guess that's also important to me, but instead, it happens so often that you find yourself waiting for the next invitation. It's not very common that artists take a lot of initiative. They take the initiative to make artworks, but whenever they get to show, it really depends on which institute or curator or gallery invites you. And I thought that it could be interesting to reverse that a bit and just produce a body of work that I can now try and tour myself without waiting for any invitation. So it's a more proactive way of working, but it's also a way of defining a field or defining a kind of energy to work within, as opposed to, having a phone call from somebody that says, oh, I'm doing this show in Canada, and then all of a sudden you're in that kind of vibe, and then the next thing is like, oh, we're doing this in the Netherlands, and then you're in another kind of vibe. So it's also trying to kind of keep a vibe going somehow, and keep something that, art is sometimes easy come, easy go. It's another show, a number of people come, there's a number of press, people write about it, and then all of a sudden that stops. And these works, they don't resonate unless they are written about or they're like restaged. And I think that last option of restaging works and finding new context, it's very nice. I don't know if you've ever tried to see the same musician perform the same show twice, but it's very nice to see how different the same songs will sound according to kind of vibe that's going on in the crowd also. And that's the kind of thing I was trying to look for.
Gabriel, I just want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. I'm excited about the work that you're doing and have done. So I just want to thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Brandon.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.